It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Your house might not be the first thing you assume is affecting your health, but it may have more of an impact than you think. A panel sponsored by Conservation Consultants, Inc. this afternoon at Phipps Conservatory will discuss healthy housing and how your living conditions can weigh on your medical health. David Jacobs is the chief scientist at the National Center for Healthy Housing, former director of the Office of Lead Hazard Control and Healthy Homes at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and he'll be taking part in that discussion. But first, he joins us. David, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much for having me.
Would you please start by sort of assessing just how aware in general is the public about the health of their homes and how it affects our individual health?
Yeah, we've known for a long time that housing has an important causal aspect with regard to how your health does. And in fact, if you think about it, the two biggest parts of our economy that have had problems in recent years is the high cost of medical care and the lack of affordable housing and the mortgage crisis. And we think those two things are connected. They're not separate. The second leading cause of mortgage failure to make your house payment on time is because you had a medical expense. So making sure that your houses support health, not just make you sick, is an important way to drive down medical costs as well as making the housing more appropriate.
And that medical expense could be related to the health of your house?
Yes, exactly. If you're not making the appropriate investments in your homes, like correcting mold or lead paint problems, then you end up having to pay it on the back end because of higher medical care costs. Well, that's kind of, if you think about it, it's more expensive and it's backwards. We shouldn't wait for someone to get sick and then treat them in the hospital when we could have prevented the illness in there if we had made the proper investment in the homes and eliminated the health problems before they actually caused harm.
And we get the treatment at the doctor, at the hospital, and then we come back into that same environment that may have caused it in the first place or exacerbated it.
Exactly. So, for example, it makes no sense if you think about it. For a child who has an asthma attack, we send them to the emergency room. Maybe we treat his symptoms with steroids or whatever, only to release him back into the home environment that maybe caused his asthma attack in the first place, whether it's due to mold or cockroach allergens and the like. So preventing these things and avoiding just waiting for people to get sick is particularly important.
Is the correlation as simple as older homes or are more likely to be unhealthy?
Well, certainly for some things. We know that lead paint, for example, is more prevalent in older housing and they're more likely to have hazards. But many houses are fine. Right. And so, but at the same time, most houses in this country and here in Allegheny County have not been inspected for health problems. So we don't know exactly where the health interventions would be most effective. So getting that inspection, finding out what you're dealing with, and then making sure that you don't end up in the hospital is a sound approach.
Is this more than an individual health issue? Is it a public health issue?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have made some success in driving down lead poisoning, for example, but we still have 500,000 children across the country every year who are lead poisoned. And here in Pennsylvania, actually, this state has among the highest levels of lead paint problems. So it's because Pennsylvania has older housing stock. We know that there are higher prevalence of lead hazards. But that's sort of the bad news. The good news is that we know how to fix this problem. The methods for dealing with lead hazards and other housing-related illnesses and diseases, those have been, we know how to fix it. It's simply a matter of getting the political will in place and marshaling our resources to do the smart thing, not just pay for it at the hospital, but pay for it ahead of time to prevent the illness in the first place.
Are children the most vulnerable to the effects of these negative health factors, whether it's mold or lead?
Well, not exclusively.
Okay.
So certainly children are more likely to experience elevated blood lead levels than adults. But we also know that the elderly folks have a higher rate of falls in the home, and those can be avoided as well. Here in Pennsylvania, we know that there were 1,300 deaths among Pennsylvanians over the age of 65 in 2016. A lot of those falls could have been avoided with home modifications that prevented trip hazards and the like.
So it's physical characteristics. It's not necessarily a radon, a lead, a mold. It's just sort of an impediment to a safe walking maneuvering.
Right. So what is a healthy home? A healthy home means that we don't have chemical hazards, we don't have injury hazards, we don't have things like radon hazards. Here in Pennsylvania, 40% of homes are expected to have high radon levels. That's the second leading cause of lung cancer. So, you know, if we put the radon mitigation system in place, we'll have a good way to do that. So we should, I think most people regard these housing and health issues as separate. They're, you know, you make your house payment and then you end up dealing with your doctor, but they're really joined at the hip. And so we need to make progress. We need to get our political leaders to understand that these issues are in fact connected and they need to be prioritized if we're to make progress and not continue to waste money and make people sick unnecessarily.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're here with David Jacobs, chief scientist of the National Center for Healthy Housing. I understand you were at the CDC yesterday working with about 100 public health folks from around the country. Is there a greater awareness, a consensus of the importance of dealing with the lead issue?
Yes, I think there is. That's sort of the good news. There's a group called the National Safe and Healthy Housing Coalition, about 600 groups. We went to Congress last year. We asked for the necessary funds to deal with this problem, and we got more money than ever before. So at CDC, they're training people to do blood lead surveillance. At HUD, there's more money than ever to deal with lead paint problems, and lead dust and lead in soil, as well as lead in drinking water. So the resources are there. It's a matter of generating the political will, getting the local capacity in place, and then making the progress and making sure that what we're doing is really working. But we know how to do this. Lots of jurisdictions around the country do a very good job of this. I'm hopeful that here in Allegheny County and Pittsburgh, we can make some similar progress as well.
I understand you're the principal author of both the 2000 President's Task Force report on childhood lead poisoning, in 2000. Nearly 18 months ago, Allegheny County began universal testing of children for lead in their blood. About 2% were found to have elevated levels, but several communities had 10% or more of their young children with elevated levels. Even in Wilkinsburg, nearly one in five kids with elevated levels. Beyond remediation, what else can be done to address that issue?
Well, certainly it's a great idea to do more screening. But to be honest, I don't really believe that we'll ever be able to test our way out of this problem because and in fact, that's what we do in many places around the country. We wait for children's blood lead levels to get to a certain point, and then we do an intervention. That's exactly backwards. We should be testing, in addition to testing children, we should also be testing the sources of lead that can cause harm before it causes a problem with them. And so that's really the challenge. That's what the HUD lead program is really all about, fixing these lead problems before children are unnecessarily exposed.
Pittsburgh has thousands of vacant houses. Is it possible to safely rehab or repurpose older housing, or should it be a matter of tear it down, start from scratch?
Well, every house is different, but I think in most cases, homes can be repaired. The methods of mitigating lead or other healthy homes hazards are well known. And so certainly the lack of housing, particularly affordable housing, is why the cost of housing is so high. So affordability is part of the equation in generating good health conditions. So I say yes, rehab those homes, make sure that they're lead safe and have other environmental hazards remediated, make sure they're energy efficient, because we need to do that as well, and then make them priced appropriately so that people can afford to live in them in a healthful manner that enables our children and our elders to be the best and the brightest that they can be.
So it's healthy and green.
Exactly. Housing. Exactly right.
Do you think the housing industry in general is aware or active in the conversation about housing and health?
Well, they are in some locales, but if you don't have the houses in the mix, then we're not going to really be able to make the progress. They tend to think of things as an affordability issue. The health people tend to think of it as a medical problem. These are flip sides of the same coin, it seems to me. Both of them rely on a problem, recognition of a problem, instead of taking proactive action. So here, for example, I know there's been a proposal to register rental properties and inspect them so that people know what they're getting into. A lot of jurisdictions have done that around the country with great effect. So it's being proactive, not just waiting for people to get sick, but making sure that the houses, whether they're vacant and being rehabbed or already occupied, are in fact safe and healthy for the occupants.
What are short-term steps? I want to ask you short-term and long-term. Short-term steps to making our current housing healthier.
So there are a number of things we can do with good maintenance, proper cleaning. Those are sort of short-term fixes. Taking care of pests, making sure that we don't have hazardous agents. Those are sort of the immediate fixes. But in the housing world, we also have things we call like capital improvements, replacing a leaking roof. Replacing windows has been shown to be enormously beneficial. Windows have the highest levels of lead dust and lead paint on them, and you also get the energy benefit, and people like windows. So the value of your home actually goes up.
So they say that's a selling point. New windows is a selling point for if you are moving, correct? Yeah,
yes, and exactly right. So that's why pricing the house to reflect its health condition is needed so that we can bring the usual housing finance systems to bear on making health investments rather than just waiting for people to get sick and then paying a huge medical cost down the road. It makes no sense, and it's exactly backwards.
In a sentence or so, what factors need to be considered for long-range planning?
I think strategic planning is actually quite vital. You mentioned the president's task force report. We did a 10-year plan that basically said this is what it will take to solve this problem over 10 years. This is how much money it will cost. This is how much money we will save. That kind of strategic planning should occur at the local level. I know you just completed one here in Pennsylvania, so I think strategic planning is absolutely essential so that the right people are at the table.
David Jacobs is chief scientist of the National Center for Healthy Housing. He will be taking part in a panel discussion this afternoon in Pittsburgh, hosted by Conservation Consultants. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, are President Trump's trade tariffs the best strategy to win compromises from trade partners? We'll talk to AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka about how the Trump administration's policies are affecting organized labor and the economy. And the Skinny Building downtown is an oddity of Pittsburgh architecture. It might be the narrowest building in the country, but it also has a historic connection to the civil rights movement. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Most people thought that a Tammy Wynette, George Jones reunion would never happen, but on this day in 1995, the formerly married couple released their ninth and final studio album called One. The pair's rocky relationship had been painfully detailed in Wynette's autobiography Stand By Your Man in 1979, though Jones vehemently denied being an alleged abuser. By the time One was released, both had gone on to successful marriages and even more successful careers. One would end up being the last album that Tammy Wynette recorded before her death in 1998. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Sometimes when we're trying to fix one environmental problem, like carbon pollution, we cause another. Wind turbine blades killing bats. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Pretty much everywhere wind turbines are installed, we see mortalities of bats at those facilities.
Malia Bayless is with Bat Conservation International. She says between 2000 and 2011, as many as 1.6 million bats were killed by wind turbines.
Those estimates sound high, but we expect them to become much higher. According to the Department of Energy, the wind energy capacity in the U.S. is expected to double in the next 10 years. And we also expect wind turbines to increase in both size and efficiency, which is basically going to allow them to capture energy at lower wind speeds. And this is going to allow for more wind development in areas of the country that currently it's not economically viable, like the southeastern United States.
Pennsylvania's Game Commission has a cooperative agreement with energy companies that operate wind turbines in the state. Is that common? Are these kinds of agreements effective?
It's not common, really. Pennsylvania is one of the few U.S. states that have explicit guidance for monitoring for bat fatalities at wind energy facilities. And they are also one of the few states to implement a threshold policy.
That's where if an energy facility kills more than X number of bats per turbine, the company has to implement conservation measures.
And Ontario is the other one. Ontario has a threshold policy as well. It's a somewhat experimental approach to managing the wind impacts to wildlife. And one of the things that these threshold regulations in Pennsylvania and Ontario have pointed out to us is that we really need to have more consistent ways of estimating how many bats are killed and a better way of comparing wind facilities to each other to understand why some wind energy facilities are killing a lot of bats and why other wind energy facilities aren't killing so many, even though they are in pretty close proximity to one another.
How does Bat Conservation International work with groups and industry to minimize bat deaths?
Bat Conservation International is a founding member of the BWEC, which stands for the Bats and Wind Energy Cooperative. And for the past 15 years, the BWEC has been a place for wind industry and the Department of Energy and state and federal wildlife agencies and university professors to really work together to find solutions to this problem of bats being killed by wind turbines. The most effective way to keep bats from being killed right now is to modify the way that turbine blades operate, particularly at low wind speeds. And the reason it works is because bats are the most active when wind speeds are low, so on those low wind nights. And most turbines begin generating electricity between like 3 or 4 meters per second, and that's called the cut-in speed. So the BWEC figured out that if we simply increase that cut-in speed a little bit, say to like 5 or 6 meters per second, and then feather the turbine blades, which means to pitch them parallel to the wind, that'll keep them from spinning at those lower wind speeds when they're not producing very much electricity. If we do that, we can save about 50 to 75% of the bats from being killed because the bats don't really fly at those higher wind speeds. There's some electricity production that's lost, but by most estimates, the electricity lost is not very much, like 1%.
Malia Bayless is Senior Director of Networking and Partnerships at Bat Conservation International. According to the Pennsylvania Game Commission, new wind energy projects have dramatically dropped off in the state because federal tax credits for the industry expired. But now that Pennsylvania's climate plan calls for an increase in renewable energy, the wind might be changing again. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka spoke with workers across the Rust Belt this week to share labor's concerns about President Trump's efforts to renegotiate the NAFTA deal with Canada and Mexico. Trumka's first stop was in Pittsburgh, 60 miles from his hometown of Nemacolin. Before speaking at a Southside Union Hall, Trumka sat down with 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter to discuss the deal and how his 12 million members are doing in the age of Trump.
Mr. Trumka, thanks so much for joining us here in Pittsburgh. Welcome back. I know this is your old stomping grounds.
Good to be home.
So tell me about what the goal is here tonight. You're kicking off this event, this kind of town hall tour here in Pittsburgh. What are you hoping to accomplish with the tour?
One, we want to inform our members and the general public about where the state of trade is right now. We have an agreement, so we want to talk about that. And then two, I want to hear back from them after we give them the facts, hear back from them where they want us to go. So we've been working over 2 years now with the trade representative, trying to get an agreement that is good for working people, good for our communities, good for our economy, and good for our country. And we've made some improvements. Unfortunately, it's not made any improvements yet in the enforcement side of this agreement. And in fact, you can argue that it's even worse than the old NAFTA when it comes to enforcement. So no matter what an agreement says, if you can't enforce it, it's useless.
How so? How is it worse? What were you looking for that you don't see in the agreement as it stands?
The Mexican government has used a low-wage model to try to drive investment and jobs to Mexico. So they artificially keep wages low. They're supposed to set up a new court a new Department of Labor, train people, and resource it. And we haven't been able to see where they have, one, the new court system set up, two, they haven't had the Department of Labor set up, three, they haven't trained any people, and four, the resources aren't there. And furthermore, President Trump just made that worse by insisting that they send a lot of troops south to the Guatemalan border to be able to enforce the labor law. They need resources. And when those resources get sent off in another direction, there's no money left for them to enforce the labor law. It's like our country. We actually spend 10 times more on labor, on immigration enforcement than we do labor enforcement. $24 billion we spend on immigration enforcement and only $2 billion on all the labor enforcement. So the first thing is, can they actually do what they say they are going to do? The second part of enforcement, in the original NAFTA, either party could block the formation of a panel. A panel is like the arbitrator. You bring in a panel and they make a decision on the case. This agreement goes back to the original language, and any one of the three countries can block a panel, which means if Mexico violates its rules, they can simply say, we're not going to have a panel, and there's no way to enforce the agreement.
So if Mexico, and I don't mean to disparage the efficiency of the Mexican government, but if they don't meet these goals, there's nothing in the agreement right now that says we opt out or there's any kind of sanction against Mexico nothing. For not meeting those goals.
Nothing. We want to have a more effective enforcement. We're looking at something that's being drafted right now that would prohibit goods from coming into the country if they're made in violation of the trade agreement. So you could stop them at the border.
What kind of interaction were you having with the White House up until they rolled out the agreement last year?
Well, we've had a working relationship with Bob Lighthizer. I've known Bob for...
You mean the trade?
Yes, the trade rep, yes. We've had a great working relationship. Bob's an honorable man. And we went to him with over 130-some proposals to make the agreement better. Some made their way into the agreement, some didn't. We're continuing to talk. We told him that it has to be enforceable. He understands that. And we're continuing to work together.
How much wiggle room is there for negotiation at this point? You're talking about some fairly fundamental things to this agreement. Do you have a sense that there'd even be a way to address these concerns in the agreement at this point?
Absolutely. We talked to the Mexican chief negotiator from the Mexican government, and he said for enforcement purposes, they would be willing to open up the agreement. Everybody's trying to create this deadline that if you don't do it by today or tomorrow or the next day, it's going to fall apart. We don't look at it that way. NAFTA was the worst agreement that we've seen in our country. We've had 25 years of experience with it. It's cost us over 1 million jobs. It's cost us wages. It's cost us health care. It's cost us pension. It is more important for us to get this right than it is to get it done today or tomorrow or early next week. And I think it's a foolish mistake, because I believe if that agreement were pushed to a vote today, it would lose, because it's
in
not,
Congress.
It would, because it's not ready for prime time. It has no enforcement mechanism. It gives Big Pharma too much of a break. It would give Pharma a monopoly on the entire continent for 10 years, which means no generic drug company could even begin research until the 10 years was up. Prices would go up in every country, and as I think you would agree, drug prices are already too high. Our employers that provide health care through the employment system, we don't want to see them pay unnecessary costs.
I'm curious, though, if the president understands and Mr. Lighthizer understands the need for enforcement, and the Mexican trade representative said they were open to having enforcement provisions, why weren't those provisions in the agreement that we're looking at right now? What happened that they didn't make it?
There's a lot of pressure by corporate America and multinational corporations to maintain the status quo. They're making more money and they like it that way, so there's a lot of pressure. Moreover, his administration isn't monolithic. There's a bunch of people in
the understatement of the year.
Yeah, I am noted for my understatement. There's a lot of people in that administration that just want to get it pushed through.
How would you assess the president's performance on labor issues thus far in his term?
It's been disappointing. The tax bill encourages outsourcing. It does away with taxes on subsidiaries that are overseas. So if you can produce it here and pay 20%, or produce it in Mexico and pay 0%, where do you think they're going to produce it? So it encourages outsourcing. We fought for health and safety regulations on beryllium, on silica, on injury reporting. He's rolled all of those back. We had a provision that would have helped with overtime, brought overtime to 5 million people. He rolled that back, and over 2 million people won't get overtime now that would have gotten it otherwise. And I could go on and on and on with a list like that.
The perception, at least, is that Donald Trump did very well with even a lot of union guys. Are they seeing the president's tenure in those terms?
I think they're a whole lot smarter than people think they are. They're not uninformed at all. When it comes to their well-being, their health and safety, their ability to send their kids to school, their ability to get ahead, they understand. They're very, very, very savvy. Look, he got 3 percentage points more of our members than Romney did. Unfortunately,
Mitt Romney in 2012, yeah, Republican presidency.
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have clarified that. But unfortunately, Hillary Clinton got 10% less than Obama did. Our members didn't trust her when it came to trade and other issues like this, because here's where workers are right now. They don't believe the economy, nor the political system is working for them. So they were looking for somebody to change the rules. In marches Donald Trump, who says, I'm going to change the rules, I'm going to do it all. And he's changed the rules, not necessarily for their betterment. In fact, it's been to their detriment a lot. They see where he's doubled down on the old rules. They see where he's doing stuff that actually hurts them. And so I think he's going to have a much tougher time this time around.
One hears a lot of conflicting signals about the economy locally, nationally. When you come back here to Western Pennsylvania, your hometown, I'm sure you see miners you grew up with. I'm sure you see steelworker members. How are things right now for the average working person here in Western Pennsylvania and across the country when you're talking to these folks? What's real for them?
I think there's a lot of pressure on them. You know, I think their wages are pretty flat, pretty stagnated. They don't see a path upward for them. And it doesn't matter about the stock market. I mean, they're not sharing in that by and large. I think they're concerned. They're saying, look, we work harder than we've ever worked. We ought to be making a little more money. Our companies are more profitable, but it's not coming to us. We're losing health care. It costs too much, and we're losing what we have. Our pensions are being taken away from us. Look, we're the richest nation on the face of the earth at our most rich point in time. It's not a matter of having the money to do all those things. It's a matter of people with the power don't want to share that money with the rest of us. The system's been rigged against the average working people, and they know that. And now they're looking to fight back.
Mr. Trumka, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
That's WESA's Chris Potter speaking with AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. If you work downtown, you might pass it every day and never even notice it, but the Skinny Building at the corner of Wood Street and Forbes Avenue has a little-known history dating back to the 1920s. Storyteller Mark Hauser is a frequent contributor to Pittsburgh Magazine. He's director of news at Robert Morris University, and he's here with us today in advance of his lecture this evening at Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation in Wilkinsburg about the Skinny Building and some other fascinating tidbits of Pittsburgh architectural history. Mark, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right down to it. How skinny is the Skinny Building?
Good question. So the Skinny Building, and for anyone who doesn't know, that's at the corner of Forbes and Wood downtown, and it's built onto the side of a larger building, and it's 5'2", eyes of blue. Doesn't have eyes of blue. Sorry, giving away my age. But yeah, it's 5'2" wide, which makes it the skinniest building in the whole world.
Is it, or is there a challenger?
Well, yes. I've already disappointed so many Pittsburghers by explaining that we don't have more bridges than any other city of the world.
Now, what are you doing to us?
We're definitely second place to, if that, to New York. But we also don't any longer have the skinniest building in the world. But we did. We did have the skinniest building in the world. The skinny building was, but a new building has been built in the last couple of years in Warsaw. It's an artist's house, and it's 4 feet wide at its widest point. It's between two large apartment blocks, and they win now. They have the skinniest building. So I don't know whether we can console ourselves with the fact that at least for a long time we were the champions of skinny building.
All right, we're still the skinniest in the country, though.
Yes, definitely skinniest in North America. Maybe in the Western Hemisphere, we could still say that, right? Because this other one's in Poland. There was a challenger in Vancouver, but that was a load of nonsense. We're definitely a skinnier building than theirs.
Okay, so who built it and for what purpose?
Well, it's got a fascinating history, Kevin. It was built by a greengrocer named Louis Hendel, a Jewish guy who moved here from Buffalo. And he was a greengrocer down in Market Square. Now, the problem that he ran into was that he didn't have a building. And so he would sell on the sidewalk. And the place he liked to sell was this narrow, narrow patch where the building is today, which had at one point, you got to roll back a second.
Okay.
Forbes Avenue, right there, used to be called Diamond Street, and it was a much narrower. And when they decided they wanted to bring the trolleys in, and they widened the street, and so they had to chop a whole section of buildings and lots off of that northern side of Forbes Avenue, then Diamond Street. And so most of the buildings just got their noses cut off, but some of the lots that were facing Wood, a couple of them were completely removed, and one of them was chopped. The 80-foot-long lot was chopped down, so it was just 6 feet wide, but still 80 feet long. So it was basically useless. Andrew Mellon bought it as an investment. But then Louis Hendel used it for his vegetable stand, his greengrocer stand.
So as interesting as the physical characteristics are of this structure, you discovered a connection, though, to the civil rights movement?
Right. That's right. So Louis Hendel had to fight a lot of opposition, but in City Hall even, not just the other grocers, just to be able to stay there. And eventually he built a three-story building to prove that he had an actual structure on the property, and that's why it was built, so he could sell his groceries. But he wanted to rent out the top two floors. And in 1928, he announced that the upper two floors, there was a huge story in the Pittsburgh Courier, which was our African-American newspaper, praising Louis Hendel, who had opened what would be the only restaurant in all of the Golden Triangle where African Americans could sit down at a table and be served dinner. So, I mean, otherwise, you had to eat at a hot dog counter at a Five and Dime, or you had to go back to the Hill District, but black people weren't allowed to go into restaurants.
So was it a success? Did it thrive? I mean, we're talking, what, a year before the crash, though?
Yes, you're correct. And no, unfortunately, it didn't. It didn't survive the Depression, which happened in the following year, of course. And that was the end of the Lincoln Restaurant. So what most people remember as a restaurant in that building was a hamburger hot dog stand on the ground floor that was there from after World War II, basically up till about 1980. Mm-hmm. And that was called Ray Wells, and is supposed to have had good hot dogs and hamburgers, I hear. Never got to eat there.
That original restaurant, I mean, do we know if the proprietors had any effect on their neighbors during the time that that restaurant was open?
Boy, you'd like to hope that it inspired someone somewhere to make the next restaurant where African Americans could sit down and enjoy a lunch or a dinner without being chased out. But unfortunately, we kind of know the history of America's civil rights, and 1929, 1930 wasn't a time when we could be confident that would happen.
What's going on with the building now?
Well, for a long time, it's been kind of an art installation. Unfortunately, a building that's only 5 feet two in depth, all it has is a narrow spiral staircase to get to those upper floors. So they're pretty much useless, other than maybe for storage. But the windows have been used as art installations over the years. I think there's still a vendor, or from time to time there are vendors in that ground floor. And in the front end of it is actually an entrance into the 7-Eleven that occupies the larger building abutting it.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking to Mark Hauser about the skinny building in downtown Pittsburgh ahead of a lecture this evening in Wilkinsburg. Another topic for your talk this evening, bit more modern in the sense that it's in the news, still in the news today. Billboard of Mount Washington, it's tied up in litigation. The Zoning Board of Adjustment ordered the sign to be removed. Lamar Advertising appealed that recent time. How far back, though, does this billboard date?
Well, that's amazing. I wrote recently about it for the Pittsburgh Magazine, about an organization called Scenic Pittsburgh that right. run by Mike DeWita. I think you've had him in here
sure.
on the program.
Former county commissioner, state rep.
Right. And opponent of the giant billboard that Lamar owns up on top of Mount Washington, which right now has an American flag on it.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, if you talk to them who are Pittsburghers, remember it being an Alcoa billboard. Or even at one time long ago, it was a WTAE billboard. But they also remember and it was Miles and Bayer for a time, too. And people remember it blinking the time and the public
sure.
service messages. But it goes back more than a century. It was the oldest picture I can see of it on this sort of moonscape scarred Mount mm-hmm. Washington with all the dead. There was no trees on it because mm-hmm. all the mill smoke and what have you. Was for a men's clothing store called Solomon's at around 1900, right around the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the same place, there was a billboard there.
What was, at that time, what was the public reaction to a billboard? Were there concerns about the view?
There were. Not initially with the Solomon's one because it was smaller, but the owner of that billboard, which was a guy named Henry Posner, and his company was called Alpha Sign and later Pittsburgh Outdoor Advertising, as I said, the site of Mount Washington looked like garbage. I mean, mm-hmm. there were no plants growing on it. And so as you rode up the Duquesne Incline, it was a nice place to put a sign. You could read it from the incline as you looked over the dirt. But what happened is Mr. Posner then decided to expand that site, and he put up a huge Hollywood letter-style sign that was for Clark's Tea Berry Gum, made here in Pittsburgh. So big letters, not a square sign. And there was a big fight over how high that sign was allowed to be and whether it would obscure the view from Grandview.
Legal fight now. Was that a legal fight then as well, though?
Oh, it was. They the police were, you know, sent to prevent erection of a larger billboard for a time there. It was because of the city planning office. But in the 1920s is really when zoning became a thing, and thereby the sign was grandfathered in a sense. It was on Mount Washington before the zoning ordinances started, so it's always been there in one form or another. And other signs were also on Mount Washington, but all of them have been successfully removed. For the most part, I can't think of any other prominent ones, but that one remains.
Finally, is one of your goals, beside getting people to read your work or attend one of your lectures, such as this evening's, to just stop and take a look at the varied architecture we have in the city?
Oh, boy. Absolutely. I couldn't say it better than that, Kevin. I mean, we've just got a city with amazing buildings from all different eras. They're incredible to look at, a wonderful skyline, and so many interesting stories behind them, too. So I just love digging into those stories and finding out and sharing them with your listeners.
Well, briefly, is there another one on the horizon that you've begun your research into? You can tease us a little bit?
Well, yes. There's coming soon in a Pittsburgh magazine near you are some stories about 50 years ago when a couple things got their start in Pittsburgh, including the ballet, including a guy named Chuck Knoll, and including...
We've heard about him.
Yeah, including Pittsburgh Magazine. So,
all right. Storyteller Mark Hauser is a frequent contributor for Pittsburgh Magazine. He's the director of news at Robert Morris University. You can hear more from him this evening at 6 at the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation in Wilkinsburg. Mark, thanks so much as always.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure as always.
For today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with MasterChef contestant and Pittsburgher Michael Silverstein about gathering inspiration in the Strip District and serving his dishes to celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay. Plus, a look inside Pitt's newest nationality room, celebrating Philippine culture. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.